Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org. Welcome. I think with newcomers, it must be something. Depends. Sometimes you've had some exposure to Buddhism. Buddhism's around more than it used to be, but sometimes it must be strange just to come in here and observe all these different forms that we observe: the walking, the chanting, the bowing, and today I want to talk a little bit about that. One of the things about a space like this, one of the things about the forms, I'll say, is that it kind of makes a different space for us to practice in. You know, we come in here and we do something different. We kind of make a sacred space in a certain way with these forms that we observe. But I'm also aware that they're strange. You know, they're not of the culture, American culture, Western culture. And that provides, that there's a little bit of tension there. So, like, when I went to the monastery, we did, I mean, it's probably not an exaggeration to say 10 times as much form as we do here. So we've cut back on that, believe it or not. But at the same time, wanting to provide a kind of different experience for people, an experience that allows them to let go of themselves for a little while before going back to life. Sometimes the forms, the culture kind of catches up with some of the forms that we do here. When I went to the Zen Center in the late 80s, early 90s, nobody was shaving their head. Like, in order to, you know, shaving my head was a big deal. I went back to see my grandparents after I'd become a monk, and they just couldn't believe it. Especially my grandmother, she couldn't believe it. You know, I walked in the door, she just hit me. Oh, Chris! My grandfather said, "Well, Jane, at least think of it this way, at least he didn't become a Catholic monk." The only people with shaved heads back then were like cancer patients or skinheads, which is one of the reasons that I did not, the Sasaki Roshi, who I studied with, wanted to kind of bring back the swastika, which is because that's a Buddhist symbol. You see it all over in Japan. And early 90s, I told him we can't do that, you know, with our skin heads and our swastikas on the back of the cars. Anyway, so then Michael Jordan shaved his head, and everything changed. And now everybody over 50, you know, every guy shaves their head. And so it's kind of caught up in a certain way. And I used to think that bowing and chanting were the two strangest things we did. Now even bowing to me, you know, all people bow all the time. You know, the stars, they go off and to get an award, they bow. So bowing is kind of catching up. I'm not sure chanting is catching up yet, but that's the subject of my talk today. I think it might. It might be a little bit easier over decades to kind of approach chanting. Right now, it seems to me it's a little bit difficult for some. And even I, when I first came to the monastery, chanting was difficult. I just was, well, you know, there it was 45 minutes of chanting, and it was Kanji Zai Bozagyo Jinanya Ramita Jijo Gengo Ngai Guru, like that. So it was really like it made a kind of inside and outside. You know, those folks who'd done it for many, many years, the insiders, that was easy. They could do it. For me, I was just completely lost. And so one of the things that I hope we can do as a community is bring people along with some of these forms, make them feel not like I did, just kind of stupid, make the threshold low enough that it's easy enough to join in. So we chant, we do it more slowly here, and one of the reasons I wanted to give this talk was just to give people an idea of how you might enter into this chanting form. One of the things about all the forms that we do here at the Zen Center is that there are some subtle things that happen with form. One of the things I think is that it brings us together in a certain way. We all do the same thing. And in somewhere in the background, that helps us, that strengthens us as we do this difficult practice. It's true of our daily practice. It's very true in a retreat, where the form is like becomes like a container that holds all of us, a safe container that we can lose ourselves in. This practice, fundamental practice of losing ourselves, is not an easy thing. When I say lose myself, I mean give up our thinking self. That takes it takes some effort, and it's helpful to have a kind of structure around us while we do that. And these forms also give us a way, all of them do, to do something silently, to give ourselves over to something silently. So when the shoji serves tea, she comes up and just is moving without having to think. And when you receive tea, you're just receiving tea without having to talk or think. This space becomes a place where you can, it's almost in like a, I hope in a Pavlovian sense, when the tea comes, you know you can just do this activity without thinking. You don't have to fuss around or worry about it. You just can give yourself over to that activity. And that is something that we can do with all of our forms, is just give ourselves over, put ourselves into that activity without thinking. It's not many things that we get a chance to do that in our lives. We're always thinking about this, thinking about the next thing, thinking about this thing. If we can give ourselves over to just receiving tea, if we can give ourselves over for just walking, we can also give ourselves over to washing dishes at home. We can give ourselves over just to mowing a lawn. So chanting is another way we give ourselves over to something. And if we put ourselves into chanting completely, like I said just before we chanted, it works best, chanting, when we don't hold back, when we open up our body and let it sing and ring your whole body like a bell. Ganji Zaibo Zagyojin. And really go for it. It's harder to go for it when you just stepped in the door. But over time, it is quite possible to... It is quite possible to hold back. And just, and that's okay. There's no... I mean, nobody's going to come around and talk to you about it. But my feeling is to really get past your shyness and get into it changes the game for chanting. It did for me. Chanting has other ancillary positive effects. One is that it gets your breathing going before sitting. There's no way, if you really chant, you won't get your breathing going. And that prepares you for the sitting, in my view. It also is kind of a vigorous practice. Again, if you do it like I just suggested you do it, there's a kind of a strength to it. And, of course, it's loud, too. Like, it gives everybody strength. Today, I thought, we're all together, and boom, 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 boom. And that's a that's a, I think that's a nice way to start the day and sitting like this. I can feel my wife, Lita, feeling some hypocrisy, calling me out, maybe. Because when at the monastery, there were some negatives about the morning chanting. First of all, it happened at 3:15 a.m. And second, it was like a warm space where there was no... The zendo was pretty cold. The chanting hall was always warm. And there was nobody with a stick there walking around. So... it was just the perfect place to go to sleep. And I slept through most of my chanting at the monastery, the first chanting. There was an afternoon chanting on during retreats, and I stayed up for that usually. But the morning one. But if in a place like this, where we're all well slept, you can really feel the energy. And I think that helps. It's also a communal activity, of course, chanting. We all do it together. And it was, by the way, at the monastery, and this is true in Japan as well, I just recently read, it's the one thing that everybody has to go to, chanting. You don't have to come to the sitting all the time. The tensos, they don't sit. They're just busy cooking, doing that kind of practice. But everybody comes together for the chanting. There's no exceptions. Our chanting, unlike singing, has a certain kind of... a monotony. It's one tone. And we just keep that. So you don't have to be able to follow music on the plus side. Nobody sets that tone. Like, we just find it in the room together. So right now, this time, for instance, it was too low for me. I mean, there is a kind of a often kind of a male-female dynamic sometimes. You know, if it goes up, if it's comfortable for enough people here, then I've got to go down. There's just no way I can get up high enough to get an octave up. But we just sort that out on any given day, just where we're going to kind of fall. And sometimes I try to push it, like especially trying to get it higher, because people, I know it sounds beautiful low, and it did today, but sometimes there's just more strength to it if it's higher. But I just, many times, I can't, there's only so much I can do to try to convince people to go higher with my voice. And that's affected by many things, by the way, by the eno, for instance, by the note that she ends on, by the tone of the bell, just where we end up. So I suggest that you throw yourself into chanting, but also chant with your ears, as I was told at the monastery. You know, listen to where other people are and get in where you fit in. Get in with everybody else. Sometimes somebody's way out of pitch. And another thing I want to say about chanting is that it's one of those activities that I believe is strangest on a day like today, on a Sunday when we all come together. And it most sings, if you will, during a retreat. For me, it has this effect of changing the energy during a retreat. When we're sitting all day and then we chant, it's a different practice altogether. There are a couple of things like that. Walking in steps, another one. It's kind of odd here. And it's kind of more difficult than just not walking in step. But during a retreat, when we're all walking in step for a whole week, it's a beautiful and wonderful thing. Yeah, and of course, like walking in step, chanting also has this rhythm, this rhythmic aspect. Bum, 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 bum. There's rhythm all throughout our practice. Without going deeply into that, that can be another talk sometime. So I want to open it up in just a minute to you, to ask you what you think about chanting, how you use it. The last thing I want to talk about is, look at these, But these are like half of the books, the other half are at home, chanting books that I have of different sorts from different traditions. There's just a lot. There's a conversation that's happening right now in the West about chanting, you know, how to do it, how much to do, whether to translate into English or keep it in the old Sino-Japanese. You know, we kind of split the difference here. We do some of each. And on the plus side of for translation, I think, and I should say, I mean, Kaplo Roshi, I think, pretty well broke with his teacher over translation. His Japanese teacher did not want him to translate. He wanted to translate everything into English, and that both felt very strongly about that. So this is the kind of thing that really divides people at times. On the plus side of translation, I'll say, you know, we know what we're chanting. We understand it better. We can get a little feeling from it, emotional feeling from it. Might stick with us afterwards. And I think even though Japanese... Max, you're here. Even though Japanese monks, you know, I've been told many times they don't really understand it, but still the characters give you some feeling, don't they? Some, even though it's very old and it doesn't exactly add up. Yeah. So whereas we, you know, Kanji Zaibozan, we're in the dark completely about all of that. On the other hand, on the plus side for the old style, not translated, it's also less of a creed that way. You know, when you walk in the door, you're just doing this practice, this bodily practice. You're not saying the Apostles' Creed when you come in. And I also think, this is a very subtle thing, but it's important to me it's just nice for me. Like, we went over to Japan. I didn't actually hear anybody chanting the Heart Sutra, but we heard some of the chanting starting. I think it was at Kaninji, maybe. And we just heard the afternoon chanting get started. And I strained to listen for it. And I would have, of course, understood all of it. You know, they chant exactly, they chant the Lotus Sutra right through the Four Great Vows, just like I did. And that's a very nice feeling. Whenever I go over to Norway, for instance, and practice there, you know, we're doing the old chant. They do the Heart Sutra in Norwegian. They do everything else in the old Sino-Japanese. And so there's kind of a global language in that way. And these old syllables, even though they might not, they don't mean anything to you when you get started, they take on a certain meaning over many years. So this is really subtle. But for me, well, actually, I remember when, Sandy, you know, when I was chanting for her on her deathbed to chant the Heart Sutra, you know, in Sino-Japanese, was so comforting to her and meaningful to her. And even, I remember Darren Hewson, his daughter, he's a minister, his daughter got sucked under by some cold water when they were hiking in a river. And right down the river, they pulled her out. She was effectively dead. And they restarted her heart, I guess because she'd been cold, it saved her. Anyway, all this was happening in real time. Somehow I got the message, and, you know, he's a ministry, pray for me. You know, everybody was sending their prayers. And all I could do, I went out to work, stuffing cushions, and I just over and over again, Namu Samanda Moto Nano Harachi Kojo Jasin Sono Nanto Jito Engyaki Agyaki. That's the Dharani for preventing disasters. And it felt so good just to chant that over and over and over again. It felt almost like maybe I could push the universe just a tiny bit. I don't really believe I can. But it felt like maybe I could do that. It was, nice feeling. I could go on more, but I really want to stop and just ask you, what do you think about chanting? How do you use it?
From what part of your body do you chant?
Thank you. That could have been something I'd talk about. I did talk about your whole, ringing your whole body like a bell. But really from, and this I teach to the people who are chanting up here, really try to chant from your belly. Just like you breathe from your, we teach you to breathe from your belly. Chant from your belly too. Feel your belly when you chant. It changes it. It really changes it. If you lower, well, it's just like opera singers, right? They're told to chant from their, to sing from their core, from their belly. Do the same thing. It really makes a difference. It makes it more steady, more stable, and more pleasurable as well. Yeah.
So my only experience with chanting has been with kirtan, which is a totally different experience. And this is one of my first times here, so I had never experienced like the monotone chanting. That was a little bit like, what's but I recognize the gata gata parasam gata. Mm-hmm. Isn't that Sanskrit?
Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand the combination between Sanskrit and Japanese and the connection and how that's done here.
It's a mess. I mean, it's like in the Heart Sutra, for instance. It's most of our chanting is a kind of corrupted version of Japanese, or an old version of Sino-Japanese, we call it. Mm-hmm. But there, the mantra there, gyate gyate paragate parasamgate, that's Sanskrit, Pali even, and then there's another chant that we have in our longer chant book that we do on retreats, which is just Japanese. It's the Kozen Daito. And the Four Great Vows, that's another one that really goes back to Sanskrit as well. So they're sort of all over the map.
So how were they selected?
Good question.
How did the combination begin?
Yeah. I don't know enough about that.
Okay.
But in Japan, all of these were collected into for the Rinzai tradition into this, starting with the Lotus Sutra, which again we didn't do today, but starting with the Lotus Sutra, very long, 13 pages of, and then going on to the Four Great Vows, taking about 45 minutes, and I don't know how long that canon has existed. I'm guessing it's a couple, 200-300 years, something like that. Do you know? Happen to know, Max?
No.
But yeah. But it is, a lot of it doesn't make a lot of sense. I have the translation here, and anybody who'd like a copy of these are the translations of our chants. And, you know, the Dharanis in particular, the one that I was just doing, the Namu Samanda Moto Nano. Adoration to the Buddhas, adoration to the teaching, Om Kya Kya Kya, Hum Hum, Jaba Jaba Pari, untranslatable, you know. So it's really just rah rah, and rah rah. So when we talk about translating things, also it's like, really, you sure you want to be translating? Yeah.
Do you mind if I share what sort of brought us in here?
Yeah, please.
We know nothing about chanting. but we rent our we have a mother-in-law apartment in our basement, and we rent it out to a gal who chants. Huh. And we heard her chanting one day through the floor. We didn't know it was chanting. I thought our refrigerator was broken.
Yeah.
Making a noise like that. Well, I thought it was broken. So my wife and I, Tori, were both over in the kitchen. We were banging on the refrigerator. And it wasn't changing. And then we realized it was the gal downstairs, and we both started laughing, and we were so intrigued that we thought we should investigate this.
So chanting for all you here. That's
how
good.
Did you like it?
The chanting? It's almost hypnotic. It's, I don't know if that's good or bad, but it felt good.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because there is a kind of hypnotic, you know, sense of it, especially when it's monotone like that. Of course, it can be in kirtan too, you know, with some up and down. And Korean chanting, I was going to try to find some Korean chanting for you. That has a little bit of tune. in a way that is really beautiful and also hypnotic. But
I think it's helpful for preparing for meditation because, especially the not knowing the words, it gives my body and the mouth something to do for a while together. And I find like even more than sitting, I think that's like the place where it's easy for me not to think.
Yeah, that's interesting. There was an abbot of a monastery I saw once on a video in Japan, and it was Aeji, the great Aeji Soto Monastery. And he was asked, what is chanting about by a Western reporter? And he said, chanting is emptying the garbage. there is that sense to like, da 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 da, and then you can just sit.
Vibration quality I really appreciate as being healing, and I think it's very healthy. But I have always had, and it used to be irritation, now I'm more just unhappy with not knowing what I'm saying. And I think that's really complicated, like why that makes me unhappy. Yeah. But I still feel like it's valid. And so I really struggle with saying things or words or when I don't really know that I'm saying as part of a group.
Interesting. Because I just wonder, Kathy, because the little book that we have, everything, I mean, you're actually doing the translation, right? Like in the set that you do the Heart Sutra and then you do the translation of the Heart Sutra and then the Four Great Vows and then there's the translation of the Four Great Vows. Does that give you any comfort or is that?
It does, yeah.
It does.
It makes me less irritable, but it's still not so sort of, because I don't know what the words that I'm saying, or the songs that I'm saying mean.
You're not alone. You're not alone.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I get that a lot. And the easy thing to say, which isn't so helpful sometimes, I think, is just, forget about it. No, I mean, that's the classic line, But I do think that it's more than that, and I just tend to encourage people to try to let go of that as best as possible, just enter into it, and then read the book. I'll give you a book.
And it's a trust thing, that's why I'm still here, because some of the formality is foreign to me, and not why I'm here necessarily. But,
yeah.
The Heart Sutra is really profound. There's so much in it. If you wanted to, I see nothing wrong with really learning what the Heart Sutra is about. Because Shariputra, Ushariputra, Sunyata, Avaksanyata, there's a wonderful book by Red Pine called Heart Sutra. And it goes into it in detail. So if you read that book and went back to the Heart Sutra, you, I think, would be satisfied as far as what it means. In English.
And I think sometimes it does help to do things like that, just to really study it, I remember one time I was the head monk and I was sitting there and, the Roshi started his talk and he said, he was referring to some line of the chant. Maybe it was the meal chant or I don't remember. Anyway, he said, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And he said, Koshin, translate. And I said, I don't know. And it was so funny. He said, you don't need to know, of course. You don't need to know what the... You just chant. Chanting is just chanting. On the other hand, you'd think if you'd been around for as long as you have, Koshin, you'd have gotten curious about what he meant.
I'm really grateful
chanting really does feel foreign to me.
Yeah.
And I feel a bit like an imposter in a way. Sometimes I sit there with a sort of a grin on my face thinking, what the heck? I have no clue. But this was really helpful. A lot of thinking, a lot of good thoughts in the conversation about coming to it, just coming into it, has been really helpful to me. Whether I ever study it or not, I'm grateful for the opportunity to really go deeper into the why of it and the what of it. And the only thing I think of, you know, I grew up Catholic, and I think of the Gregorian chant.
Yeah.
And you said in the beginning, you know, I don't know if chanting is coming back, but it's like, yeah, there are lots of traditions where the chanting is so integral. And here it is here.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know, we'll see what happens in the future. But I do think you have to be able to, I do want to encourage people just to sort of play act, you know? I mean, the worst is Gildo, right? Beth talked about it in her talk. She calls it Gildon't. You know, where it's just walking one step at a time. Con. G. Za. I mean, it's wild. And I remember I told Bill, you know, like, because he was like, what is this all about? And I said, just play. Just like pretend like you're a samurai or something, you know? Ah. And that changed it for him completely. Yeah. He really got into it. You know? Like, so there is a kind of play acting in a certain way that we can do. Did you want to say something?
Yeah. So a thought that goes through my head when I first started doing kirtan and when I start chanting here, and it's a language that I don't understand, is I wonder if, like, we're a room of mostly white people. It's like, is this cultural appropriation? Like, if I don't know the words, is that disrespectful to people? Would the people whose language this is be okay with me saying these words without a full understanding of it? And it's like, is it selfish for me to just get really into it without paying it that full respect? And there's all those thoughts of that. But I just wanted to bring that into the room.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a newer thought than there used to be. I mean, yeah.
But weren't you saying that a lot of the monks don't even know what
it means? Oh, they appropriated it from China, and, you know.
Yeah. I mean,
and then from that way back. So I think I tend to think, you know, we can riff off of, you know, all of those things.
But is it still appropriation then? If it was appropriated, then are we just appropriating it further?
I mean, there's one way in which I feel like everything is appropriation, you know, like, and Buddhism in a certain way, more than many things, really is cool with appropriation. It has been all the way through. Like, because it takes on it's like, use this as you wish, and it takes on some of the flavor of wherever it lands as well. It's been famously kind of flexible that way. So, I think, you know, we're changing things. We're changing it as well. Okay.
I like the idea of the vibration connection piece that I think about, and I appreciate what you're saying, but I think there's another connecting piece happening beyond the language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beyond the language. Yeah, yeah. Well, I just want to end. I'm sorry, but I gotta do it now. So with a song which I like. My mother sent me this song. She heard it on the radio on WUNC in North Carolina, and she loved it so much she bought me the album, and then I looked up the person who sang it, and that person is in the album is on in Seattle. So I called him and said, would you ever maybe come over here to kind of play this song sometime? He said, oh, well, I could, but, you know, it's not my song. The guy who wrote it lives on Vashon Island. And that is, what's his name?
Steve.
No, I know it, but I can't think of it. Anyway, sorry. I'll tell you later. I know I met him at a party. We had a big long laugh about it. But here it is. This kind of, to me, gives you a sense maybe of, I feel very much this way, or sometimes I feel very much this way about chanting.
I once was a Baptist, and each Sunday morn, I'd be in church praying, as sure as you're born. We'd sing there like angels, in a good harmony.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.